So just who is he? Who is Jesus that we call the Christ? Who was this man that came 2 millennia ago? Who was this man that you and I claim to be fully God and fully human? And what was it about him that affected so much change throughout the entire world? Just who is he? Those are good questions, I think, that we are going to explore, and I think it's worthy of our thinking. But all those questions I posed were in past tense. Who was he? What is it that he did? You know, those are past tense kinds of things. But we believe him to be present and with us today. So similar questions is, who is Jesus today? What is it about him today that affects all of our lives to the extent that it really does? Who is he to you? And who is he to me that shapes our very being and our very essence and affects every aspect of all of our lives? This is what we started working on a little bit the last couple of weeks. And, you know, really, I think it's the job of the church to continually ask those questions, because we're never going to fully wrap our minds around who Jesus' identity is and who he is to us and what his impact is in our lives. But that's the business of our church, to continue, as we said last week, to continue to seek and to ask and to search and to knock on his door, because we want to be close, and we're asking him, tell me more about you. We want to be close to you. We want to be near. We want to know you, and we want to know about you. We desire to be like you. That's an ongoing thing that the church ought to do. And we followed up this, looking at this, exactly who Jesus is. You know, we talked a lot several weeks ago about, you know, who are we? You know, what is our identity? Who am I? And now we're looking again here with similar questions. And who is it that we say Jesus is? And I think those two questions are going to be very related. I think the more we understand and who it is that you say Jesus Christ is going to identify who you say you are, because they're so related. I think one of the fascinating truths about Jesus Christ is the manner in which he came was pretty... It was pretty unlikely, the way he came and the way he lived and the way that he died. You know, there was no grand royal line of royalty in him. He became pretty common. He was born as a lower class person. There wasn't, you know, a great coronation that crowned him king when he was here, a great leader, but yet today we call him the King of Kings. He didn't have any great educational degrees or anything like that that was established. He had no major campaign budget or no wonderful social media band that was following him. That wasn't of his time. He came kind of in a unreal kind of way, an unlikely kind of way. He came quietly. But what he said lasted for so long. And why is that? He came humbly, but now he's the Lord of all creation. And he came as one who served when he was here, and he calls us, his followers, to do likewise and serve. I think at the time that he came, it would have even been more likely for us to look, we can look back now as one thing, but I think at the time, to think that this person and what he was doing would have the influence on his community and his culture just would have been kind of unthinkable, let alone what he did for the last 2,000 years. And it's kind of extraordinary when you think about that. You think of all of the human leaders that have come and the impact that they left. And yet this person comes and has left, no doubt, the most biggest impact on all of culture. A couple things to think about here. Think about what Jesus looked like. We have no records. There were no selfies. You know, we didn't have those then. What was his image? There was really not a whole lot of evidence that would describe what his character was like. But yet, you know, there's several images that are flying up there on the screen. The one on the upper left, I think, is believed to be the earliest image that was painted of Christ in the 3rd or 4th century there. But if you think about this, you know, especially the middle ones there, he's the most recognized image in all the world. We know. We have this. We all have this recognition of who he is. But yet when he came, no one bothered to mark down or write down, you know, he was 6'2", he had such and such skin color and eye color. We don't know. But because he was so important, we've established this identity to him about what he looks like. And we look at our window there and we've got the Good Shepherd up there and we recognize right away, yeah, we know exactly who that is. How is that? How does that work out? How did he come in such a quiet manner, but yet millions of people know him, what he looks like? He never wrote a book that we know of. Jesus never wrote a book. But think about the number of Bibles that there are in the world. That's pretty incredible when you think about this. He never wrote a book, but the number of Bibles that contain his story is phenomenal. If you look at this, you can't read this very well. This is one that I found here to sort of compare a little bit about the Bible as it relates to other books. This shows, I believe it's close to 4 billion copies of the Bible that are throughout the world. And this is a few years old. I found another estimate that said there's probably closer to 5 billion copies of the Bible in the world. We got several of them right here, you know, so these are ready to go out. So grab one of these on your way out, take it home and pray over it and bring it back here. And you could be 5 billion and 16 is what we have right here. We'd love to have you be participants in that. The Quran, estimates for the Quran are around 800 million. Bible, close to 5 billion. The sayings of Mao Zedong, around 800 million. Harry Potter, any Harry Potter fans? 400 million. So, you know, think about the number of Bibles that are in the world. Jesus never wrote, he never wrote a book. He never wrote a book. But there's been such an effort to compile what it is that he said and did into his book. This is a little embarrassing, but I wanted to share a little bit about how many of these books I have. And so I got a couple of shots of my den here that I work. The one on the left shows some real books that I have, you know, hardcover books with copper covers and paper. And I just quickly went through and I found 7 different Bibles that I have in my den, 7 different translations of the Bible. And that bookshelf on the side, those are going to be commentaries, and those are dictionaries, and those are encyclopedias, and they're Christian novels, and they're those kinds of things. I had 263 of those just in my den of Christian stuff that I would have compiled when I was taking some graduate work. But the thing on the right, that's where I sit and do most of my work here. This is even more kind of embarrassing. When you look at my computer, I have 36 different translations of the Bible. Now, some of those I can't read because they're in Spanish and they're in, you know, Portuguese and that kind of stuff. But it comes with my software I have. You know, there's 36 different copies of the Bible. I have 579 books, expositions of scriptures and commentaries and all this stuff. And I can have access to that on my phone as well. You know, isn't that phenomenal? This man that came and never wrote a book. And think about what it is that you and I have, we have access to. We have all these resources that we have where we can hear what he said and what he taught and what he commanded. And for sure, in our day and time, because of the advancement of technology, we have this. You know, several hundred years ago, you had to look hard maybe to find a Bible. You know, we have scores of them in our homes. The printing press was invented, and the church began to grow, and they began to make copies of this Bible that I have so many of today, and you do as well. But it was because of this push of the church that wanted to promote the story of Christ, this man who never wrote a book. And those libraries ended up turning into the first universities. Oxford and Cambridge were universities that were created for the purpose of preparing clergy. They were designed to help people that were going into ministry. And then later in our country, Harvard and Yale were done for the same reason, to promote the story of Christ, to help advance the kingdom of God through Christianity. Our whole education system has really been based upon this push to advance Christianity and Christ and what it is that he stood for. And how could have that happened? You know, when you look at it just from a logical perspective, here's a guy that came. He came humbly. He never wrote a book. But all of this has happened because they wanted to push what it is that he says and what he believed in and who he was. Maybe it had something to do with his teaching, because he taught in a way that at the time would have been very revolutionary. Maybe that had something to do with how this works out, because this teaching, it teaches us how to relate with each other. That was new. It teaches us how we can relate to our God. That was different from any other way that anyone had taught before. For sure, there is great teaching, and there's a new way of thinking when we explore Christ. And we're going to talk about some of that today and next week. But for sure, that can't be all there is to this phenomena that has happened. It can't just be a mere intellectual thing or a philosophical thing or a way that we think about things. It has to be much more that would have changed the world as much as he did. We're going to talk about that as well. I remember several years ago, a colleague of mine that I was teaching with, and I knew he wasn't a strong, faithful believer. I probably would categorize him as an atheist. And I remember having talks with him regarding different things. And I remember at one point, I made the suggestion about, we were both teachers, and you know that Jesus was a man that came, and he was the greatest teacher of all time, and he agreed with me. I thought, oh, hey, maybe he's made this change. Maybe he's recognized who Christ is. But I don't think it was. I think you can acknowledge Christ as being a great teacher and a person who promotes revolutionary ideas, but you can still miss who he really is. So I guard against that a little bit, that as we answer these questions, who is he, that we don't just look at the human side of Jesus. We recognize what is more important, his divinity, and what that has done for you and I. One of the things that he did teach that was revolutionary was how he changed his culture, and for that, the culture of all the world, on the importance of the sanctity or the importance of human life, of all human life. It has worth. It is important, and it is sacred. You and I live in a world that has been affected by that teaching over 2,000 years, but he came and taught this in a time much different than ours, because not all of human life at that time had the same value or had the same worth or had the same dignity. There was kind of a hierarchy to human life. Some humans had more value than others. Now, that's hard for me to say it. It's hard for you to receive that a little bit. That's the way people perceived things then. And for us to try to comprehend that now, it's difficult, because you and I live in this world where we make this assumption that all of life has worth and it is valuable. No doubt, we can turn on our TV and say there's still a lot of inequalities, but we know in our hearts how we think and how we act is that all humans are created equal and they have rights. But many people believe that thinking that you and I have today largely comes from the teachings of Christ and the church, and it changed the culture so much from what it was 2,000 years ago and how it continues to change our culture that you and I live in today. Things like the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, many people say that those are only in place. Those foundational statements that we have are the result of Jesus' teaching and the teachings of the church. Because those are the foundational statements that we hold so dear about our freedom and equality for all people and justice for everyone. You know, the Declaration of Independence, shortly into that, says these words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they are endowed by their Creator, an acknowledgement of a Creator, with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those foundational statements we have come, as many people believe, as a result of Jesus and His teaching, which would have been so different from the time that He would have lived in. There were boundaries where people couldn't cross because they were not equal. People were valued differently because of things like who your daddy was. If you were born by so-and-so, that puts you at a certain status. Low or high, depending on your pedigree. Your money and your power. Gender was a demarcation for people. Men were viewed so much more highly than women. How you were trained religiously or educationally gave you different value or worth. Whether you were in the military or not, if you were a slave or you're free, slavery was more accepted then than it is now. Or your age, how old you were. Were you too old that you had no worth, or were you too young that you also had no worth? Consider children during the time of Christ. John Ortberg, in a book I've referred to a few times here, is, the name of the book is Who Is This Man? Says this about children in the first century. I'm going to read the quote from the book. He says, in the ancient world, children usually didn't get named until the eighth day or so. Up until then, there was a chance that because of the mortality rate, they just would have died. So they just, let's just wait till day eight to name them, because so many children just died. That was the status of healthcare in the first century. But also, there was a chance that the child would be killed or left to die of what they called exposure. And this is where they just take the child and they expose them to the elements. And they would choose to do this if the child had perhaps a deformity, and maybe there's something wrong with them physically, or the gender was wrong. The cultures wanted to have male children. They looked down on female children. So if it was a female child, they had a strong chance that they would be exposed. Or simply if they just didn't want the child, it was accepted to expose these children. How they did this, Ortberg goes on to say, abandoned children were often left on a dump or dung hill. They most often died, but sometimes they were rescued. Usually it was for some sort of slavery use or for some other form of abuse. But oftentimes they were rescued and saved and they were brought up. But they left these babies on a dump or on a dunghill. And he found that there are hundreds of ancient names that are variations of a Greek word that's called, I don't know if I'll say it right, kopros, K-O-P-R-O-S, kopros, which is the Greek word for dung. Now stop and think about that for just a moment. Think about a culture where you would find perhaps kids that have grown up and their name was a derivation of dung because they were rescued from a dung heap or a rubbish pile, because it was okay at that time for children to just be exposed. And so all these derivations of the word kopros showed up in history because these children no doubt were rescued among the dung heap. It's kind of a phenomenal thing. Think about a culture that would accept that as being all right. This was the time that Jesus was born into. It was a time where the Greeks and the Roman cultures felt that was okay. But Jesus' culture by itself did not refer to that as being okay. The Jewish culture said that was not appropriate to do that. But if Jesus was Greek, he probably wouldn't have survived. Because we know the story. Jesus was born from a human perspective as illegitimate. And those were the type of children that would have been exposed. Isn't that fascinating that this is how he would have been brought up? He would have known in his heart how the world would have looked at him as one of the people that would be set up to be exposed. He came up in a culture where that was happening all the time and decided to teach this way. We find in the book of Mark, they're traveling along, and when they got to Capernaum, they were in a house, and he asked them, the disciples, "Hey, what were you arguing about there on the way?" He asked his disciple, "What were you arguing about?" But they were silent because they really didn't want to tell him what was going on. Because what they were arguing about was who was going to be the greatest. That's what the disciples were talking about. Who's going to be the greatest? He knew that. He sat down, called the 12, and said to them, "Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all." You know this story. And then look what he does in the middle of this culture that says it's okay to expose these children to the elements and let them die. You know the value of a child during this time. Look what he does. "Then he took a little child and put it among them, and taking it in his arms, he said to them, 'Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me.'" That would have been a revolutionary thing for his disciples to hear, because they are brought up in a culture where children have little value, have little worth, have little dignity. And he begins to change things for the world through a sentence like that. Or one chapter later, another familiar story. Jesus' ministry is continuing, and there's healing that's happening, and a lot of miracles are taking place. And in Mark chapter 10, verse 13, we read this. It's kind of a fascinating story as well. That, again, on our side of it, 2019 years later, we look at this and say, gosh, why could they do this? Here's what happens. People were bringing little children to him in order that he might touch them. I get that. I could see that happening today. Moms and dads taking their kids there and say, "Hey, can you make him be a major league pitcher?" No. But you could see that parents would do this. They'd want to have their children go to Jesus to have him touch their children. And the next line's kind of fascinating because it says, "And the disciples spoke sternly to them." Why did they do that? People are bringing their children to Christ, and the disciples, no, get them back. Get them back. You can imagine what's happening there. Why would have they done that? Well, because they live in a culture, again, where children didn't have the value that they would today. And he says this, "But when Jesus saw this, he was indignant and said to them, 'Let the little children come to me. Do not stop them, for it is to such as these that the kingdom of God belongs. Truly I tell you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child will never enter it.' And he took them up in his arms, laid his hands on them, and blessed them." For us today, yeah, we get the second part of that. We understand the value of children. We love children. We hold them up in high regard. But it's because of this. It's because of what he began to change then. That custom of exposing children stopped. It changed because a group of people who were followers of Christ remember that he told them, "Let the little children come to me." He gave them value and he gave them dignity. And it took them to the 4th century where a Christian emperor outlawed that practice of exposing children. What they did then over time, there were still unwanted children, but rather than kill them on the dung heap, they brought them to monasteries, churches of the day, so that they would be taken care of. Maybe that child that he's holding there had one of those names that was a derivation of dung. Dungus, maybe, is his name. I don't know. And he would know that. Perhaps that child there was one that was saved from the dung heap. But he has a new name now. Jesus gives it to him. He has value now because Christ commands it. He teaches us that that child is created by God and bears his image. God is the giver of life and has now given value and dignity to all of children. In my heart, I want to believe that you and I live in a world where we value all life, especially children. I want to believe that we just don't discard people or our children because they don't meet our expectations or that we simply don't want them. I want to believe that that's the culture that you and I live in because it's a result of Christ and what he taught and the teachings of the church. But yet I can't help to think about the numbers of children who are abused or neglected all the time. It still goes on. And I can't help but think about the roughly 600,000 children that were aborted in the United States just last year. Left on a dung heap. How much have we changed? You know, our world is so much better because of the teachings of Christ, but there's so much more that needs to be done. And I hope that what the world sees in you and me are people who value all human life and hold all of life with great regard because of what we've learned from him. I hope they see us as a people that has no prejudice based on race or gender or age or status. The world sees in us people who deeply care for other people because they see value and immeasurable worth, because that's how we are viewed by Christ. But that means that you and I have action to what it is that we claim. We are involved in this thing that is about loving the unlovable. The world should see that in you and I, and then they should wonder and ask, and we would respond in a way that would reflect what we've seen and heard in him. Would you pray with me?